This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by The Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com and the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 50, A Golden Passage.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And welcome, welcome back, welcome from wherever you're coming to I Hear Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Monty.
I'm your other host, Burt Wolder, and welcome to wherever you're going to.
Indeed, and we are pleased to have arrived at our 50th, yes, the 5-0. Episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. This is our golden anniversary show, and we thank you for being part of our journey over the course of these few years in this little hobby, this little undertaking that we have that we try to share with you. We've received lots of great feedback along the way. We continue to, I guess, light up the airwaves, up people's lives in some way or another, Bert, so we must be doing something right.
Yes, and despite some of that feedback, we continue to produce episodes of I Hear Sherlock Everywhere, and that's what you can look forward to.
Well, we've got another chock-full show for you this episode. We're going to get into, in a little bit later, some of the highlights that Bert and I were able to experience over the course of the 2013 Baker Street Irregulars weekend. But first, of course, we have a couple of guests that we'd like to welcome to the show, a couple of guests that have actually produced the latest volume in the Baker Street Irregulars manuscript series. The book is called The Wrong Passage, and this is the facsimile of the original manuscript of The Golden Pince-Nez by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which, of course, appeared in The Return of Sherlock Holmes. And the two editors that undertook this book, and we'll talk a little bit about what went into that and what it consists of in a bit, the two editors are Bob Katz and Andy Solberg. Gentlemen, welcome.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on your 50th show.
Well, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on a great book.
It's been a great run for you guys so far.
Yeah, so
now,
far.
Now look forward to another 50.
There you go. Well, with your help, we'll get there. And congratulations to two of you on putting out this really excellent book. I've actually had a chance to go through the whole thing in the scant week since the BSI weekend, and it's probably one of my favorites in the series so far.
Well, that's kind of you to say.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And I'm not just saying that because you're on the show. It's actually, it's been an enjoyable read. You know, the manuscript itself, probably one of the cleaner manuscripts of the Conan Doyle undertaking. You know, there's a few that have a few scratch marks through, a lot of edits and whatnot, but this one was really struck to see almost how, you know, what Conan Doyle wrote in the original is pretty much what we saw in the printed page.
Isn't that incredible? You know, as we say in the introduction, this isn't one of people's favorite stories, but still, it's Conan Doyle knew exactly what he wanted to say when he wrote it.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of Andy, you and Bob, knowing what you wanted to get out of this project, why don't you take us back a little bit? First of all, you're both BSIs, and I'd like the audience to get to know each of you a bit, because Bert and I have known both of you for, well, seemingly forever in Sherlockian terms. And you're great friends, great friends of ours, and you know, we want people to get to know you a little bit. So, Andy, why don't we start with you? We'll go alphabetically, A before B, unless you want to go alphabetically by last name. You know,
no, I always defer to Andy. that's why the project succeeded. I always defer to Andy.
So, Andy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe about your professional life, how you came to Sherlock Holmes, and your association with the BSI, what your term of service is with the BSI, as it were.
Well, I read the stories when I was 10 or 11, and I frankly found them boring. And I put the book away, and I thought, this isn't for me.
And, you're kidding, right?
No, I'm not. And I 10 years later, I picked up a random book, and it happened to be the Sherlock Holmes stories, and I've been rereading them ever since. And around 1976, I published an article in the Baker Street Journal on the philosophy of Sherlock Holmes. And I then moved down to Baltimore from Boston. And because it had just been published, they said, didn't you just publish something in the journal? And I lived off of that for many years.
Well, how did you come to write that? Were you a student of philosophy then? Were you
My undergraduate degree was in philosophy, and after I graduated from school, I was still looking for something, you know, kind of philosophical to do, and I had fallen in love with the Sherlock Holmes stories by that point, and I merged the two interests. And I joined the Sherlockian community in Baltimore and then started going to Philadelphia and New York for the weekend and started being invited to the BSI around 1993, and I was invested in 2001.
And your investiture?
And my investiture is Professor Quorum, which is why they asked me to get involved in this book.
So, any background or any hint for us as why Professor Quorum would have been chosen for your investiture?
You know, it really was a sobering experience. I'm hoping that it's not. I expect that it was partly because Mike Whalen saw me as a bit of an academic. I had taught at the Hopkins School of Public Health. I hope it's not because he thinks that my personality is similar to Professor Quorum's. Professor Quorum really is one of the bigger worms of the canon.
Yeah, he is. He is. Well, fantastic. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention how the two of us first became acquainted. Of course, we each have a healthcare background. I'm no longer a practitioner in the field, but first became familiar with you, if I recall, on the Hounds of the Internet. And I remember your signature at the end of every post was cogitat ergo est.
Right. He thinks, therefore he is. And sometime in the 90s, I wrote an article proving the existence of Sherlock Holmes using Descartes' ontological proof. And, you know, Descartes said, cogito ergo est, I think, therefore I am. And what is Sherlock Holmes best known for but his level of thought?
Indeed. Indeed. Well, that's, you know, just a couple of great examples. That couplet of BSJ articles that you mentioned as to how people can really tie in a number of other interests and influences to the canon. So well done.
Yeah,
well
thanks.
Done. Why don't we move on to Bob? Bert, maybe you'd like to wrangle the intro with Bob here.
Well, I mean, you know, the history of Sherlockians and people with this enthusiasm are punctuated by the association with presidents and luminaries, and also many members of the sciences, Banish Hoffman, who was a protege of Albert Einstein, but also eminent medical men, and I think we may count the ever modest Robert S. Katz, M.D., in that community of eminent medical professionals and pathologists. Bob, how when did your first connection with Sherlock Holmes happen?
Well, it's a little, the beginning part is a little bit different from Andy's in that I actually liked the first Sherlock Holmes story I read. But I remember, as I must have been about the same age as Andy, 11 or 12, seeing a Rathbone film on television in New York one afternoon and being so smitten by it that I literally walked out of my home afterwards after the movie was over and walked to the library to get a copy of anything from Sherlock Holmes. And basically I was hooked at that point. And then I just stayed interested, and some years later came across a newspaper article about the Baker Street Irregulars, and I sent a letter to Julian Wolfe, who was the head of it at the time, and he sent me back the usual form letter about, we only invite you after you've been active for years, but here's how to subscribe to the Baker Street Journal. And then I guess when I was finishing medical school, I wrote an article for the Baker Street Journal that was probably published right around the same time as Andy's, 75, 76, something like that. And Andy moved to Baltimore and lived off his article, and I moved to Philadelphia to do my residency, and I guess lived off mine for a while. And then I just got active in Sherlockian activities in Philadelphia. I'm sure I met Andy in the late 70s. Well, I still lived in Philly. But then in 1980, I moved to Baltimore, and Andy and I became much better acquainted, of course, at that point. I got my shilling in the BSI in 1983, so this is the 30th anniversary when Julian Wolfe was still in charge, and I'm Dr. Ainstrey, who's mentioned as being the greatest living authority on tropical medicine. And at the time, I was interested in stuff like leprosy and plague, and I thought Julian had really looked into it very thoroughly and researched my background, and then I kind of realized that that was probably the only medical title that hadn't been given out as an investiture in the BSI. I just happened to get it. So anyway, it's been 30 years of activity in BSI involvement.
And your other great area of connection to things Sherlockian is the fact that, among other things in your past, you are a graduate of Haverford College, which was Christopher Morley's undergraduate school. When you were at Haverford, were you doing Sherlockian things? Did you know there was a Morley connection? Did you know of Morley in those days?
I knew about Morley before I got there, although I hadn't really put it all together, I think, until I actually did get there. And one day I found myself sitting in the Morley reading room at the Haverford College Library studying, because they had the best sofas. And all of a sudden dawned on me that I was at the same college as Christopher Morley. I remember when I was a kid reading the intro to the Doubleday edition and thinking, just, gee, that was a wonderful, wonderful piece of literature. And then suddenly when I was about 17 and an undergraduate, it dawned on me that I was at the same school as Christopher Morley and his brothers. So that was a really, that was very exciting. And then from then, that just, I think, just spurred my interest.
Well, how fortunate. How fortunate for you, and how fortunate for us that we are the beneficiaries of that association.
Well, thank you. I think it's interesting that all four of us have been friends for so long, it becomes difficult to remember when we met each other.
I know. Well, it's nice.
It literally
nice
goes back so long.
Yeah.
It's nice to extricate it here and have it down for the record. So
it's
when
true.
We become old and senile, we can point back to this podcast.
I think I met you, Bob, at a BSI dinner, because I think my first dinner was 1973 or 1974. But I remember being at the first meeting of the epilogues.
And that would have been 1990.
Yeah.
But I'd met you before then.
Yes, yeah, I think we'd met at BSI.
Probably was at a BSI dinner. Yeah. And Scott, I probably met you at a BSI dinner.
Yeah. I think that's true, yeah.
But I just can't remember when anymore.
Yeah. Well, as we dotter towards decrepitude, we can look on this fading of our memories. Actually, the great thing about these podcasts is we can go back and at least listen to what our memories were as they continue to evaporate.
So let's talk about the book a little bit. For those of you who aren't aware, the Baker Street Irregulars for the past decade or so has been putting out a series of books under the collection called the Manuscript Series, where we managed to locate and transcribe one of the original Conan Doyle manuscripts, and then center scholarship around that manuscript. So associated articles that would have to do with the particular story in mind. So in many ways, it's like an expanded issue of the Baker Street Journal, if you will, but that's only focused on one story, and that's got a variety of great scholarship around it. And that's the job of the editor of any particular volume of the manuscript series. There's a general editor overall, which I believe is Andy Fusco. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's right.
And then the individual volume editors are asked to pull together the variety of scholarship that surrounds that particular story. So, Andy, Bob, how in particular were the two of you, of all people, selected to edit this manuscript in particular?
Well, as I said earlier, you know, because my investiture is Professor Corum, they came to me and they asked me if I would get involved in the book. And then Andy looked at me and said, well, would you edit it? And I, at that time, you know, I told him I'd have to think about that because I hadn't edited anything in the past. And so consequently, I needed to find out what that meant. Then Bob and I happened to be sitting next to each other at the dinner, and he told me that Andy had gone up to him and asked him if he would edit a book for the series, and Bob told him no. And I said to Bob, wait a second, don't be so hasty. Maybe we could work together on this, and we know we'll get it done. And Bob said, yeah, that'll be fine. And so then it was off and running.
Yeah, I said no because I just wasn't, and I'm still not very tech savvy, and I just was uncomfortable in this electronic age taking on a book that would clearly be done pretty much electronically all the way through. But by coincidence, after I turned Andy Fusco down, I think it was the Thursday night of BSI week, and I sat next to Andy Solberg at the BSI dinner, and we started discussing it, and I realized that Andy, of course, is a lot more tech-savvy than me, which is great, and thought the opportunity to work with him would just be a lot of fun. So Andy and I both walked across the floor of the Yale Club and found Andy Fusco and said, okay, we're in, but as long as we're a duo. And Fusco said, yeah, sure. And that's how it happened. That was 2010.
Hmm. And you have to remember, Bob and I had been friends for 30 years, so that we knew that we would enjoy working together. Right. We didn't know that we would work together as well as we did.
Yeah, we were hoping that two good things would happen. One was that we'd get the book done, and two was we'd still be friends at the end of the process.
Right.
And I think that both took place.
So right. What was the process like? So after you made the commitment, how did you get started? How did you chart the voyage of pulling this together? How did you make the decisions? How did you consult the manuscript?
Well, first of all, Bob and I started kind of making a list of the things that we would really like to know more about that story. And when we had essentially a draft table of contents because of the subject matter that we wanted to cover, then we started thinking about who would be the best people that we knew who would be able to address those areas. And that was actually pretty quick. That came to us pretty quickly.
And what was your thinking? What was the subject matter you wanted to cover? What did you want to know more about?
Well, go ahead, Bob.
Well, I was going to say we worked on the table of contents together, and certainly the international issues were important. The issue of what kind of poison was involved, the ophthalmic issues were interesting to us. They're just, you know, lots of issues that when you read the story again, the great thing about any Sherlock Holmes story is, even if you've read it many times, as all of us have, when you reread it, you realize there's some angle that you either hadn't noticed or hadn't really understood or didn't still understand and wanted to know more about. And those things just sort of came to us, Andy. I think that's a fair assessment of how things happen.
And this story has some interesting facets, like the palimpsests that Holmes is studying at the first at the beginning of the story. And, of course, there's also Professor Corum's area of study that he thinks will, you know, shake the foundations of modern religion. You know, those are real gifts to be able to write something about.
Right, the Russian revolutionary angle.
Right. That came to us pretty easy, as did the people. You know, in terms of the palimpsests, not only is, you know, Don Pollock a great physician, an anthropologist, but he also had worked at the Folger Library in Washington, D.C., in the antiquarian book restoration section before he went to medical school. And I thought that he would be a perfect choice to talk about that. We had both read Al Silverstein's article in the Baker Street Journal many years ago that discussed what Corum was studying, and we wanted to see if he could bring anything new to what he had previously written. So little by little, the people kind of came together.
And then there was the just incredibly good fortune that we had, which is that Randall Stock and Phil Burgum, who really do the manuscript analysis, had been involved with previous BSI manuscript series books and had agreed to get on board for this volume, and they're just really pros. They've gotten this down to a really fine art of going through the manuscript and picking it apart and finding out fascinating details and transcribing it and annotating it. And we were just really lucky that they were basically in the car as it was getting warmed up, because they just consistently do a terrific piece of work on this sort of material.
So let's talk about that for a little bit. Randall, of course, keeps the website bestofsherlock.com, where he archives and catalogs not only the manuscripts from the Canon Doyle manuscripts, as well as some of the original artwork from the Canon. Randall, obviously, is, you know, very good at what he does, a real expert in the manuscripts. Where would one go look for the manuscript for the Golden Pince-Nez if one wanted to find it in the wild?
It's at the University of Texas at Austin.
At the Harry Ransom Center?
At the Ransom Center, exactly. Right. I guess by the time I sort of really got fully involved in this, there was a few months gap between the time that Andy Fusco asked us to get started and when I retired from practice and actually had time to really, you know, work with Andy Solberg on this. And during that period, the manuscript got scanned. So I sort of missed out on the tech part of it, but it's in Texas at the Ransom Center.
And of course, you know, one of our recent shows, I believe it was episode 48, where we covered the Conan Doyle diary. Just a beautiful representation of his original manuscript there in imagery, of course, almost as solid and full color. Doesn't need to be, because Conan Doyle didn't illustrate it the same way. But again, you can see his original handwriting and how neat it was. You know, Bob, things must have broken down at medical school in between, where you guys actually had to take an unpenmanship course to be a physician. I don't know how he got away with it.
Conan Doyle really is the exception to that rule, isn't he? I mean, he writes so straight, and everything is so readable. He really puts the rest of the field and most of us to shame.
Yeah, but that was a characteristic of his four production work, I think, because if you remember the Stashower Lellenberg letters volume, mm-hmm. apparently a lot of his casual handwriting was kind of messy.
Well, that's good to know.
and some of it crept
into
the... You did, actually. But some of it crept in, because that's how we can find some of the discrepancies of dates and names and locations that we're all you know, chasing after as part of the grand game.
Yeah. But see, I think it's worth a second, you know, just to mention that, particularly for listeners, you know, who might be new to the idea of a manuscript series, the magnificent part, you know, as you become attracted to the works of a particular author, you know, say Conan Doyle, there are people who collect first editions in the world of Sherlock Holmes. You can collect the original Strand magazines. You can collect the Strand magazine bound volumes. And then there's sort of the Holy Grail, the manuscripts that were actually in the hands of the author, that the paper that he actually put his pen to. And then if you're really interested in the research, the value of the manuscript is what words were struck out, what sections were rewritten right before publication, or where are the inconsistencies between the words that appear in print and the words that were in the manuscript as it went to the publisher. And for years, the only way to explore that work or to do that kind of research was to go to the Harry Ransom Center or go to the library and get the permission to look at the manuscript. But the value, really, of this manuscript series is now, you know, you too, for the paltry sum of $35, can have a copy, essentially, of that manuscript in your hand, plus all of this commentary. And
that
are the enthusiasts, you know, that's what's really exciting here.
I was going to say that Phil Burgum really does a wonderful job of almost going word for word and identifying how the manuscript varies from the Collier's edition, the Strand edition, and the collected works. It's really a phenomenal task. I don't envy him that part of the book.
Yeah.
No, what always what struck me very much as Andy and I were working on this is that this is the sort of thing that's never going to happen again. Modern authors, no matter how great they are, do everything on a computer. And there's never going to be, no matter how great a novel comes out in the future or other piece of literature, there's not going to be this kind of document. The days of a handwritten manuscript are gone. Everything is now, you know, done electronically, and the typing is corrected by spell check or whatever and transmitted through the internet. And this is really a lost art. So we're really had the good fortune to work with something that's literally sort of the end of an era.
Yeah,
and let me
go ahead.
I was going to say, let me tell you that it's a lot less anxiety provoking to hold the book in your hand than it is to hold one of the manuscripts.
Yes. And in a moment, I think you're going to ask us about what's coming up in the future, and we can explain exactly why Andy makes that statement.
Yeah,
but
we'll
he's
look
absolutely
forward.
Correct.
We'll look forward to hearing about that from you guys, because from what you told us in personal conversation at the BSI weekend, that it's really fascinating. But you know, looking through some of the essays here, I'm struck by Randall Stock in particular is able to make able to spin gold out of straw, as it were, no pun intended, with the golden pince-nez. But you know, it's more than just unsurfacing the manuscript itself. I mean, he actually looks at the history of the manuscript. And in particular, there's one section of his essay called How Copying Affected the Canon. He looked at the carbon copies that were made and how Conan Doyle must have he concluded that Conan Doyle must have kept the third typewritten manuscript to compare with the proof. And he deduced that based on the number of illustrations that were or were not available in particular copies. The fact that Conan Doyle wanted to bind some of his manuscripts together for preserving them for the future, because by that point he realized that he was really onto something and had something to offer posterity. So, just some fascinating things about, getting into the nitty-gritty behind the manuscript and the process itself that wouldn't necessarily be apparent to the casual reader.
No, I think it's really great that the Baker Street Irregulars have devoted an entire series of books to reprinting and analyzing these manuscripts. I think until the BSI got involved, I think there's a reproduction of The Dying Detective, and there's one of, is it The Solitary Cyclist? Was it the one that Marv Epstein owned I'm having a senior moment.
I think
moment.
That might be is the Lion's Mane.
Lion's
is
Mane.
That,
Lion's Mane. Okay, there are only about two books that I can recollect off you know from the hip that reproduced the manuscripts, and they were published quite some time ago, and really within a very short time. In that sense, the BSI has put out just several of these volumes, and I think it's terrific that they're willing to put the effort to making them available to people like us that would ordinarily never have seen them. I mean, you know, Scott, you mentioned if you want to see the manuscript, go down to Texas, but that's really not so easy to do.
Right.
And Randall really does do a great job. I mean, he talks about how Conan Doyle gave this manuscript as a gift to Herbert Greenhouse Smith, who was his editor at the Strand Magazine. And he follows the manuscript through to the present day when the Ransom Library bought it. And it really, you know, he tells about the individual owners and gives some history of them as well. So it's you really do get a full sense of knowledge about the history of this manuscript.
Yeah.
We were very fortunate that Phil and Randall were basically in the project when we arrived because they just are so thorough.
Yeah, and you know, between that and what you identified earlier with Don Pollock and Al Silverstein, I mean, so much of the early work, obviously, that goes into the editorship of these volumes, it really comes down to relationships. It comes down to, of course, institutional knowledge about who's written what and when, but it does come down to having personal relationships with these individuals and understanding their areas of expertise or their hobbies.
No, Scott, you're absolutely right, because one of the, I think, a good example from this book, when you talk about relationships, is Andy and I were discussing doing something on Russian nihilists and revolutionaries, and it just, the light bulb went off in my head, and I remembered that a Haverford College classmate of mine, Bill Wagner, is a professor of Russian history at Williams College, and I just seen him been in touch with him about reunion business, and I sent him an email just out of the blue and a copy of the story and asked if he'd like to do something for us on nihilists and revolutionaries. And amazingly, he wrote back and said, sure. And if you had a chance to read his essay, I think it's wonderful.
And Bob, you mentioned to me during the BSI weekend that was your favorite article in the entire book.
I'm, of course, a little biased because Bill and I were literally schoolmates met when we were about 17 years old. But based on the comments I've gotten from a lot of other people, I think he did a wonderful job. And it really is, I think, just a terrific piece of work. And what's great is that this is someone who has not previously contributed to the Sherlockian literature. And this was his sort of first appearance. But you said it came out of relationships.
Indeed. Indeed. So have you converted him into a Sherlockian now?
We're working on it.
Andy, you were going to say something there?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, it's very easy in the BSI because so many people are so accomplished, and have so much area of expertise that, you know, Al Silverstein had written this great article. What year was that, Bob? Was 1999 or something?
Something like that. Yeah, it was a while back.
And that related to this story, and we asked him to revisit it, and he just did a wonderful job that talks about how what Professor Corum may have been studying may have related to the instructions that Moses had given to Moses' successor. I mean, it's really a stunning analysis, and all the analyses are at that level. Peggy's analysis, Peggy Perdue, did a chapter on the influences on Conan Doyle on this story. Dick Swim did an article on the Golden Pince-Nez and how Conan Doyle, who had been trained as an ophthalmologist, used the word convex when it should have been concave.
And Paul Martin and Jacqueline Morris did a really nice joint chapter on basically death in the story. trauma and the one by poisoning. And, you know, you just, what's great about the BSI is, as Andy said, there are just so many people that are so good at so many not only interesting but unusual things that you can't actually find these folks. And it turns out a lot of them are people that we've been friends with for a long time.
Right.
Well, that's the best part. I mean, one of the great attractions of things that are Sherlockian is how one relationship, one bit of knowledge, one interest, one insight leads to something else. If you start to read the essays of Christopher Morley, you follow his enthusiasms to Robert Louis Stevenson, to the books of David Grayson, to the novels of George Gissing, to the things that amuse him. And if you follow the community of irregulars, you know, you find that you're surrounded by eminent and interesting people, often in the most unlikely places. Everything from funeral directors to eminent pathologists, as it were.
Yeah.
And somewhere in between.
Yeah.
No,
right.
It's just, I think all of us just really love being irregulars and being involved in the Sherlockian world. And for me and Andy, first of all, as he mentioned, it was a chance for us to do a project together, which was great. And then it turned out that we got to work with some other really great people. And for me, I got to make some new friends, which is always a pleasure. So it was just a wonderful opportunity for us. And we're, I think, very grateful that it was made available to us.
And I also have to say that one of the remarkable things is that all the authors met the deadlines.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. What did you threaten them with?
Well, we can't talk about that. We have another book coming up.
Right, that's right. No, the authors were really conscientious, and we gave them a deadline, and every single person met it, and really without any pushing and prodding, and I think everybody realized that there was a timeline for BSI Books, and it just got done, and it was really, really wonderful to work with all these people because they were just so conscientious.
You know, and if I could go back to what we were saying about the some of the authors and their levels of expertise, because I want to mention someone who I know is a really good friend of yours, Scott, John Besh.
Yes.
You know, if you're going to ask anybody to do anything about travel during Victorian era, it's got to be John Besh. So, he was our choice, and he just did a wonderful job in his chapter. So
we should also the evidence boxes, Andy. You want to mention?
That's right.
Yeah.
Paul Churchill was a member of the BSI. He's passed away a number of years ago. But he used to collect evidence boxes, artifacts that are mentioned in the stories. And, you know, like many of us collect books, Paul collected things. If there was a cataract, the cataract knife that was mentioned in
Silver Blaze,
the Silver Blaze. You know, it's not only a cataract knife, it's a, I don't know, a Seiss cataract knife. He would have one there from the period.
Right.
And he collected these for each of the 60 stories. And when he passed away, his sons gave them to our local scion that Paul helped found, Watson's Tin Box, in Ellicott City or in Columbia, Maryland. And the tin box allowed us to photograph the evidence box for Golden Pince-Nez and put the photographs in the book. We're relevant. And Denny Dobry did a nice chapter on things that you read about in the story and wonder what that looked like. Well, we have pictures of them.
Yeah,
so,
we've got the spirit lamp, the sealing wax knife, even Egyptian cigarettes. Kind of dissecting
and for those
a number
people
of these
that didn't
things.
Have a chance to know Paul or to see his evidence boxes, this is now for posterity, I think. Paul was just a great guy. And fascinating in the sense that what he couldn't find, he constructed. And he'd make reproductions of things if they just didn't otherwise exist.
We would call those genuine faux articles.
Absolutely.
And the photographs were taken by Beth Austin, who did a wonderful job.
Yeah. Oh,
that's great.
So we were very lucky. We had a really terrific crew to work with.
Excellent.
And I'll say that Jacqueline Morris's take on Anna taking the poison will change the way you read that in the story from now on.
Yeah, you know, yeah. that was a really fun one, especially when she collaborated with Paul Martin, yeah. Another eminent physician within the BSI, to come to that conclusion. So he took a very, pathological, scientific approach, and it was nice when it was coupled with Jacqueline's approach as well. Really, really nice collaboration there.
Yeah.
Now, was that your suggestion to throw the two of them together?
Yeah. Yeah, both Bob and I thought that the deaths in the story would fill about one full chapter. Mm. So that was our decision.
Yeah, and they I'm not sure they really knew each other before working together, but they certainly collaborated very nicely.
Yep, and they've become friendly since. So that's nice.
Sherlock Holmes bringing people together for 125 years.
That's right.
That's good. So,
brought to you by the G. Washington Coffee Company, Country One.
So speaking of bringing people together, it sounds like the two of you are going to be continuing to collaborate on yet another BSI manuscript project. You want to give us a little preview as to what that is and how that came about?
Well, I think probably Andy and I had a moment of being overcome by enthusiasm, and we actually volunteered to do something.
Wow.
Is probably sufficiently unusual that went along. No, Andy and I had such a good time doing this book that we said, gee, wouldn't it be fun to do another? And I said, well, if we do another book in the manuscript series, the manuscript that I really wanted to do was The Second Stain, because it's the manuscript that's at Haverford College, in the Haverford College Library, and it made its way there via Chris Morley. And a lot of the details, of course, I'm going to learn as Randall and Phil work on it, but it at one point had been in the possession of William Randolph Hearst, so it's kind of a fabled manuscript. And the manuscript, as opposed to the one in Golden Pantsney, which I think Scott said was a fairly clean manuscript, this one is a very complicated manuscript, and I won't go into the details because that's for the book, but it's a very, very different manuscript. And we suggested this to the BSI Books team, John Berquist and Andy Fusco and Mike Whalen, and they said, well, see if Haverford will let you do it, and the college could not have been nicer to us. And Andy and I were there in December, and that's where we had the experience of scanning the manuscript, and Andy said, "It's a very unusual experience to actually be holding this in your hand. It's almost as if it is a historical document, and just being allowed to sit there for a couple of hours and work with it was, I think it's fair, Andy, to say, it was really a remarkable experience for us."
So, what kind of security do they have around you when you're handling a century-old manuscript like that?
Well, they didn't really have any. I mean, first of all, they knew that we were responsible, trustworthy people. They knew that we call these writings the canon, and that we were going to treat them as sacred, the manuscript as a sacred document. But, I mean, I said, are you going to provide the linen gloves? And they said, we don't use gloves with that. We use, you'll have clean hands. We'll provide the soap. We wanted to make sure that we didn't have any oops moments. So while we really enjoyed being and holding and cradling the manuscript, we were glad to give it back.
Let's put it down here and get a couple of cups of Starbucks. Pass the buttered rolls. Yeah.
No. That was one of these things that we got into the library and started doing the scanning. And when we were done, we were, I think, relieved to hand it back to the librarian. And because as Andy said, the last thing we wanted to have was an oops moment with that yeah. document. But it was looking back on it, it was great fun. But I'm sort of glad we're done with that part of the task.
Well, you know, I mean, as fraught as you were with nerves, at some point, it must have been absolutely earth-shattering to think, you know what? This is the very same paper that Conan Doyle himself touched.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it really is, for people like the four of us, it's just a remarkable experience to spend that amount of time with that kind of material. I feel really honored that we had the chance to do it, and I'm very appreciative to my school that... that they let us work with the manuscript. And obviously they're one of the things that we're going to be looking at in the upcoming book on Second Stain is not only the manuscript itself and its fascinating history and the handwriting issues which are fascinating, but the connections between Haverford College and the Sherlockian world and the Baker Street Irregulars, and it's a lot more than just all three of the Morley brothers and me at the other end of the historical spectrum. There's a great deal that went on in between that involves Haverford College and Sherlock Holmes and the BSI, and hopefully we're going to have the opportunity to tell that history.
Well, that's great. Yeah. We're all grateful to Haverford College for not only giving us that opportunity, but of course for giving us Christopher Morley.
Yes, and his two brothers, all three yeah. of whom were alumni yeah. and great Sherlockians. One of his brothers was eventually president of Haverford College. Mm. So, wow.
Well, and his father. His father was a mathematics professor there, wasn't he?
Right. Chris was apparently, I think, born on the campus.
Wow.
So his father was a mathematician, then eventually moved to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, but was a math professor at Haverford. So, and there are a lot of other connections which we're going to get to talk about. And then we've got some other ideas which we're not going to tell you about at this point. Because we're in the process of working with the contributors. But we've got some, I think, other really interesting people that we're hoping to have on board and topics, because it's, they're all great manuscripts. And this is just a great because it's different from the other the manuscript that we did with Golden Pantsney. It's a physically different piece of work, and it's a different story, and we're already well into it, and we're very enthusiastic.
Yeah, it really has different aspects that are interesting, not only in regard to the story, but in regard to the manuscript itself. Without giving too much away, I'll just say that the evenness of the Golden Pantsney manuscript is not reflected in the Second Stain one, and we've got some other stuff. There are some other things that exist in regard to this story that we expect to include in the book that we couldn't include in relation to any other manuscript. So it'll be another good book, I think.
Yeah, I think it'll be somewhat different in its focus because of the nature, as Andy said, of the manuscript and the materials available to us. But we're already having a good time getting it underway.
Yeah.
And how big are the print runs of these things? How many copies of The Wrong Passage have we printed? Do you have any idea?
I think they told us it was 350.
Something in that neighborhood, yeah. There's a deluxe edition that's going to be coming out, which will be a pairing, actually, of the second
Scandal
Golden
and
Pantsney and
Bohemian Souls.
I think the Scandal and Bohemia, yeah. because those are the two that are... At the, I think those are the two
Ransom
that are
Center.
At the University of Texas, and I think there's going to be sort of a box dual set of deluxe edition coming out at some
point. And it will probably cost a small ransom.
That's right. Need a ransom note to get a copy.
Yeah. I don't know. But, the thing is that with two books, they have a lot of contributors, and everybody's going to want one, so they may sell it mostly to the people who wrote chapters in this thing.
Well, yeah, it's again, never before has so much been written by so many for so few.
Right.
But, we've seen great success in the in the late manuscript series, having sold out every issue. So we encourage people to get over to the BSJ website. We've got a link in the show notes for you. That'll take you right to the manuscript series page. Check out everything that's available. Scoop up whatever you can, because it's bound to not be there for too long. We'll look forward. Go ahead.
I will say, Scott, that I don't know how many they brought to New York to sell in the Huckster's room on Saturday during the weekend, but we sold out.
Yeah.
However many they brought, we sold out.
Yeah, we literally were there. Andy and I were there to autograph, and at a certain point, we were done because they were just sold all the books.
I thought your wrists were going to give out first, but that's great.
Yep.
Wow, congratulations. A testament.
Great work.
Your work.
Give me a break. Give me a break.
I know. You know, Andy, I know you're the last one that'll ever, seek the limelight or even accept the kudos when deserved. But seriously, the two of you together, what a great driving force for editorship. And I hope in the BSI manuscript series to take the burden. Oh, we have a caller.
Yeah.
we'll get to your calls in just a moment, folks. To take the burden off of any single individual to pair up editors like this, I think it's actually a genius move.
Well, I think the really good part about it is that you have somebody else to bounce ideas off of.
Sure.
And I think if I'd had to do it myself, even if I'd had the technical skills, it wouldn't have been nearly as good a book, because sometimes I'd go off on some crazy idea, and Andy would bring me back to earth, and we'd bounce ideas off of each other, and sometimes we'd finish each other's thoughts. But I just think it worked out much better having, certainly from my perspective, having the opportunity to work with Andy than to have done it as a solo act.
And the same here. I mean, we definitely brought different skills. Even the titles of each chapter are just so creative, and those were all Bob's doing. And we just brought really different skills to it, and we complemented each other, and we worked very well together, and brought it out on time, which is, you know, what the powers that be liked.
Well, it shows.
I think they were a little stunned. We said, we're going to bring it. We're going to send it to you before the BSI dinner, and it was. I think they thought it was a joke until the email arrived.
That's great.
That we had wonderful cooperation, really, all the way from the authors themselves to, you know, the BSI Books crew and John Berquist and Andy Fusco and Steve Doyle and Mark Gagan are involved, and it was just a terrific team of people to work with.
Yeah,
and all of us are doing it as a labor of love, quite literally.
That's the thing, you know?
Right.
It's amazing. This is a hobby that you're not getting recompensed for this, other than probably getting a few copies for yourself, but that's certainly not the reason you're in it.
No.
One copy.
Right, we get one copy.
Oh.
So if we want more than that, we've got to purchase it. But no, it really is for everybody involved. Just, you know, a labor of love, and just playing the game for its own sake.
Yeah.
Because we just, all of us clearly want to be involved in this kind of thing, and we've been involved, and this is just a great great vehicle for continuing that interest.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to say that both Bert and I shelled out the $35.95 for this. We did not accept a review copy because the BSI Books marketing manager, who shall go nameless, Michael Keane, did not give us a free review copy. So we bought it happily.
Yep.
And we appreciate your business.
Yeah, that's right.
Great. Well, gentlemen, on behalf of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, thank you so much for joining us, for giving us a little bit of your personal story, but more importantly, helping us understand how bringing a book like part of the manuscript series, Wrong Passage in this case, how that comes to life. Really appreciate the insight.
Yeah, we do. Well, and before we let you go, there's one question that I meant to ask that's probably on some of our readers' lips. Why the title? Why the Wrong Passage?
We really can't tell you that. Oftentimes authors don't have control over the titles of their work.
So it's like the newspaper biz where the writer, the reporter, doesn't get to write the headline.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So another mystery.
Let's just say that it's nice to be Wiggins.
It's good to be Wiggins.
When it comes to the titles of the BSI manuscript.
It's good
series.
To be Wiggins, yeah.
Well, it certainly beats the original title, which I understand was The Coconut Matting.
I don't know who told you that one.
That's fine.
Just not quite as catchy. And to look at the dust jacket, the cover that was done, the Frederick Dorr Steele classic illustration of William Gillette as Holmes peering through these pince-nez, and the script chosen for the wrong passage, actually using some letters out of the Russian alphabet to really make it apparent the connection between the Russians and the story. Really, really cleverly done.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, as I understand it, I mean, that's all Mark Gagin and Steve Doyle.
Yeah.
They designed the cover, and all I can tell you is that Bob and I are very grateful to them because it's a beautiful cover.
Oh yeah, it was. It's really well. You've got it, I think, Scott, on your Facebook page originally, and it's also, of course, on the BSJ website, and it's really quite striking.
It is indeed. It's on the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere Facebook page. If you want to go there and check it out in the photo section.
Yeah.
Great. Well, gentlemen, thank you. Thank you for, you know, this wonderful story of collaboration between yourselves, the authors, all of the editing team, the design team. You've just done a marvelous job to bring this book to the market, and we hope as many people go out and purchase it as possible.
Yeah. Great work. Thank you.
And congratulations on your 50th broadcast. We look forward to hearing the 100th.
Indeed.
That's right. And I will say this, Scott, you know, at some point I will want to talk to you about accessing the podcasts for the BSI Oral History Project. Because your podcasts really do give a breadth of knowledge and understanding of the history of the BSI, and I think it's important. I think you guys are doing a wonderful job.
Thank you. Really appreciate that. And we're just getting started. You know, there's so many that are on our hit list that we want to get to over the course of time, and of course, we have limited time to do these kinds of shows, so we hope to get through as many as possible.
Yeah. Well, that's great. You keep doing them. I'll keep listening.
Yes, and thanks for inviting us. Really
thank you.
Hey, it's four guys talking about Sherlock Holmes for an hour.
What could be better?
Exactly.
Thank you.
Lovely chatting with them. I mean, to me, this is part of what the Sherlockian world is all about. I see these guys either at Copper Beaches or in Boston from time to time when I've gotten to run into Andy or on the road, certainly at the BSI weekend. Just a great conversation.
Yeah, I agree. You know, if you look at, not to make too much of it, but if you look at a lot of the interesting social science research that goes on today about why some people in different parts of the world live longer and more contented and more meaningful lives than others, you find a number of factors that they have certain family connections, but more important, they're part of a steady community for a greater number of years in their lives, and they have relationships that they can maintain through their lives. And so in this kind of a hobby or interest, as you encounter people like Andy and Bob Katz, and they become part of the community, that's what makes, you know, at least for me, a lot of the BSI weekend very special, the opportunity to see people that unfortunately I only see once or twice a year and spend time with them. And the reason why it's so special is they are interesting and they are talented and they have made contributions. But the best part is they like what you like. And so you've got this this great common interest. And that's what's great. And I hope that the people who are listening to our podcast are also excited and engaged in that way.
Yeah. And you know, even more than having this common interest, I think that, you know, the Sherlockians that I've met, almost to a person, are just such nice people. It's just phenomenal. I don't know if there's just a civility of human nature, a civility of reading interests that bring these people together, but it's really lovely to be able to sit down with them. And, you know, we threatened to talk a little bit about the BSI weekend. We'll get to that in just a second. We're going to have a truncated version of it this show. We'll get into it in a later show. But before we do, I just wanted to make sure we mentioned our sponsors, our very generous sponsors, the folks at Wessex Press, of course. You can find them at wessexpress.com. We have some new...
Yes, I've got my copies right here.
Why don't you mention what the new copies are? Because I don't have them in front of me. I was just looking at the website. They're not up yet.
During the weekend,
we picked these up.
Yes, I'm looking forward to finishing these and talking more about them on a future episode. But the Wessex Press has come out with a couple, well, at least three, I think, publications that really should be in every Sherlockian's library. First of all, there is a magnificent reissue of A Study in Celluloid, which is the producer's account of Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes by Michael Cox. And this has been out of print for some time. And if you have any interest at all in the work involved in bringing Holmes to the stage, but also in the factors that go into an actor portraying Holmes and the work of a great artist like Jeremy Brett, you really need a copy of A Study in Celluloid, which is the series producer's account of Jeremy Brett's role as Sherlock Holmes. And also, there's a magnificent summary of The Strand magazine and Sherlock Holmes.
You know,
as most of you know, many of these stories first came to light in The Strand magazine and directly contributed to the immense success of The Strand, and a fantastic work of research and a great volume, The Strand Magazine and Sherlock Holmes, The Two Fixed Point in a Changing Age by Robert Veld from Australia, who was there and signing copies at the BSI weekend just passed. It's terrific. I mean, if you've had any curiosity about Sir George Newnes and Herbert Greenough Smith, and this, of course, you know, I think it was Stanford University a couple of years ago, because the fascinating innovation at the time, of course, was that Conan Doyle made popular the idea of a series of stories complete in and of themselves, but with a continuing set of characters and situations, which was different, obviously, from the Dickens experience when an entire novel would be serialized. And it was Conan Doyle's mastery of that form that prompted, in retrospect, I think it was Stanford some years ago, to begin to reissue the stories in serial form. Well, now all of this is brought together with a lot of fascinating research in a terrific volume. And then last, Nick Utekin's terrific book, Occasionally to Embellish, some writings on Sherlock Holmes, from Nick Utekin, who is the doyen of the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, as well as an irregular. And this is a terrific volume that'll give you many hours of enjoyment. And the first line of his introduction is the sentence, "You are in for a treat." And I think you are in for a treat if you can get these books and add them to your library. Great work.
Yeah. And of course, it goes without saying, you're in for a treat if you subscribe to the Baker Street Journal. You can find them at bakerstreetjournal.com, one of the longest-serving publications around Sherlockian scholarship, certainly recommended as the premier publication of Sherlockian scholarship. Just received my winter 2012 issue, which is a marvelous volume. I'm interested to see that there are more visuals coming about. We're seeing more cartoons. Basil Chapp, who is a rather interesting chap, He is a Parisian who is studying British literature, has a marvelous Tumblr account that just gets hundreds upon hundreds of actions on every single piece of content he puts up there. Really nicely done illustrations there. Of course, we've got scholarship concerning fan fiction, and particularly what's happening on the internet now. So it's interesting to see the BSJ evolving its editorial stance to really embrace those that are coming from the internet, interested in visuals, etc. And this this winter 2012 issue actually marks the 30th anniversary of Scott Bond's contribution to the Baker Street Journal. Speaking of visuals, he's been doing Art in the Blood as a regular cartoon feature of the BSJ for 30 years.
Amazing. And then back in our episode some months or years ago about the Sons of the Copper Beaches, I recall we had a little presentation there from Scott when he was talking a bit about his artistic inspirations, which included the great Walt Disney comic artist, Carl Bartz, right? I'm probably mangling the name.
Well, we'll put the link into the show notes so you can go back to that episode and check it out. Yeah. So, we were talking about the BSI weekend before we were so rudely interrupted by ourselves. So, we're not going to dwell on it too much in this episode because we do want to dedicate the next episode to some audio outtakes from the weekend and to give you a little sense of it. But suffice it to say, you know, I trudged out to New York from Michigan from Thursday morning until Sunday morning. And, you know, it was just, again, a reaffirmation of why I personally enjoy getting together with these people I haven't seen in person for a year, maybe more. Like you, Bert, I think that was, we hadn't seen each other in the ensuing year, had we?
Well, no, we get together, you know, at least once a year, but it's tough. I mean, I'm in New Jersey, you're in Detroit, and we're both busy, and it's our physical paths don't cross all that often unless we can arrange to be at the same Scion meeting.
Yeah, and that doesn't really happen all that too much because you're really held most on the East Coast and for your Scion meetings, and I'm here. But
this should be the year, though, we get to a conference. We really should try to do that together.
Well, there's a couple of conferences coming up this year. There, of course, is 221 – is it Sherlock Con or 221B Con, Atlanta in April? There is Sherlock Holmes in Time and – Place or Time and Space in Minnesota in August. There's another one in between there, isn't there?
Yeah.
I'm not recalling. We do have it up on the Sherlock Holmes community on Google+. We'll put a link in the show to that. But there's we're encouraging people to add events there in that community. All around the world, not just central ones or even broad things. You can put your local Scion meetings in there if you want. We're looking for that to really become a vibrant place for people to contribute to. But it does seem like a good year to get out there and take part in what's going on because there is so much of it.
Yeah, I agree. And the opportunity to do some recording and to capture some content from the folks who are attending these various conferences would make for some interesting programs. So that's part of our motivation.
Yeah. Well, good. So I'm feeling it again. I'm feeling a little bloated.
Well, you need,
little gassy.
You need to do something about your diet.
Yes. I'm feeling better already.
That's better.
So, we've talked about the Golden Pince-Nez. We've talked about 50 episodes here with you, which we have enjoyed every single one. I thought it might be appropriate for us to delve into the archives of the BSJ to go back to December 1996, which of course marked 50 years of the Baker Street Journal. It's actually volume 46, number 4. Now, the reason it's volume 46, yet it's celebrating 50 years, is because, of course, there were earlier issues of the journal before it was restarted.
And the Great Hiatus.
And the missing three quarters, as it were, right? But we find this one from December 1996 under the editorship of the previously mentioned Don Pollock. So we'll share this one with you here. And this, of course, is in Don's own voice. This issue of the journal marks the end of its 50th anniversary and the end of my first year as editor. And though the two events are hardly of comparable moment, I have to confess that I've derived as much pleasure from the one as from the other. Regarding the 50th, Scott Bond offers a celebratory cover drawing of Edgar Smith, our founding editor, to complement his drawing of Ben Abramson that appeared on the cover of the June issue. And Philip Treffler opens with reflections on the old series journal to complement the historical account of the origins and fate of that first avatar of the BSJ, which John Lellenberg offered in the March and June issues. The spirit of Edgar Smith has hovered nearby during the preparation of each of these years' issues, and I was not surprised to note that Treffler begins in his comments on the old series journal with an invocation, indeed an evocation, of the great Edgar. Just as he had called up the memory of that sacred figure in his final gas lamp as a journal in 1992. Treffler, in this issue, describes as eloquently as could Smith himself the special blend of Victorian vision and deco styling that characterized the BSI and BSJ half a century ago, when our founding fathers, and Helena Uesova reminds us that they were fathers, treated the BSI less as a Victorian or Edwardian men's club than as a 1930s literary and journalistic roundtable. Alas, this conception, or is it just our fantasy, has been inverted in recent years as the image of the BSI has shifted from the sophistication of Nick and Nora Charles, a further touch, as Noel Coward might have portrayed them, to mock Victorian mode. The nature of our scholarship has shifted, too. The BSJ was founded at a time when much of the terrain of higher criticism was being discovered and explored, and many of its early articles have taken on the cast of classics purely by virtue of being there first. By the 1990s, the Sherlockian editor might be forgiven for imagining that there's little that remains incognito. Holmes's College, The Shape of Hurlstone, Watson's Wounds, Wives, and Wine. There seems little new to say on these hoary topics. And yet, each new generation of Sherlockians seems as prolific as the last. And if the flood of manuscripts that will always exceed the flow of ideas, the wisdom of Edgar Smith's conviction that there will be no end of Sherlockian writing is amply illustrated in this year's journal. Just as no editor works in an inspirational vacuum, however much it may sometimes appear so, no editor can produce a journal such as the BSJ without a good deal of tangible assistance as well. And I should take advantage of this opportunity to acknowledge the help of at least a few people who have eased some of the burdens of producing the first four issues. Mike Whalen has been the latter-day Ben Abramson and an inspired business manager. My old friend and Baker Street Miscellanea colleague Bill Goodrich has proofread much of the contents. Any typos, errors, or oversights are almost certainly a sign that I've failed to pass a piece of text before his critical gaze. Finally, the last two editors will appreciate the anxious feeling that creeps over us a few weeks after the issue has gone to the printer as we wait for that phone call from Tom Stix. Wiggins takes great delight in pushing me close to cardiac arrest, but has never failed to be the BSJ's strongest supporter. On to the next 50.
Well done.
Yeah. You know, a couple of things that struck me as I was reading through that. You know, the essence of what Don wrote there could have been written today. You know, this was written, 16 years ago. And, you know, the scholarship continues to crank out. The BSJ itself has shifted a little bit in terms of its content style. And that's okay. I think that that recognizes the changing demographics, the changing interests, yet the constant interest of Sherlock Holmes throughout all of this.
Well, you know, all of these things, particularly the Baker Street Journal, publications like this of any kind, are living things, and not everything lives forever. The libraries are full of magazines that were once at their apex in terms of popularity, Life, Look, others that are now gone or episodic. But the great thing about, so far anyway, the Baker Street Journal is that it manages to keep up as the interest grows and changes, and perhaps ever will.
I know. And, you know, the other thing that struck me is, as I was reading that and the articles that Phil called out, I'm going to go back and read the entire volume 46, the entire 1996 set of issues, because it sounds like there's really some nice stuff in there, and I wouldn't mind refamiliarizing myself with that.
Yeah.
And, of course, forgot to mention this when we were promoting one of our sponsors, the Baker Street Journal, the eBSJ.
Yes.
Version 2, which you can get now, of course, at bakerstreetjournal.com. You can get every single issue of the Baker Street Journal's archives from 1946
issue
through 2011 on DVD.
Good God.
Easy, right?
What will they think of next? Yes, if you bought the prior edition, I think that offer is still open, isn't it? If you post in disc 4, you can get a discount on buying version 2, which takes you up to 2011.
That's right. There were four discs in the original CD-ROM collection, and you have until May to turn in disc 4 to get that. We'll put a link to the offer section of the BSJ website and the eBSJ, but you know, this is what the BSJ is about now, and who knows where the future is going to go? What the future holds? Maybe at some point there will be an electronic addendum to every issue of the Baker Street Journal that you can go online and get even deeper information from the BSJ website than you can in the printed pages. Maybe that's part of the future.
Well, it could be. That's an interesting idea. How would it be if? One of the things we should explore is, you know, could we do a special little podcast talking to the writers of some or all of the articles in a particular issue of the BSJ? Or is there other content that for one reason or another, you know, audio or video content relevant to some of these articles that couldn't be included that we could do something with? That's something to think about.
Yeah.
Something to think about. And we're interested, by the way, in what you're thinking about. Give us a call. Contact us. Tell us what you think. You can call us on the telephone, and we would love to use your recorded feedback on the show, 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. Or send us an email to comment@ihearofsherlock.com or wander over to anything that looks popular on the interwebs, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter. If you are on any of those platforms, just look for I Hear of Sherlock, and you'll find us at Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter. And it's facebook.com/IHearOfSherlock, IHearOfSherlock.tumblr.com, twitter.com/IHearOfSherlock, and leave us a review on iTunes at bit.ly/IHearOfSherlock.
And more importantly, tell some friends about the show. You know, we are delighted to welcome new listeners all the time, even though we're talking about mostly the old school BSI stuff. But you know, this is a heritage that we can all share. This is a set of storytelling sessions, if you will, a couple of old friends chatting that we think just anybody can relate to. So we welcome new and different, and of course, non-invested listeners to join us here. and share in what's a great passion for Bert and myself.
Yeah. Please do. Well, I think that probably gets us to the point where I come to the conclusion I'm Bert Walder.
And that leaves me only to say that I'm Scott Monty.
And therefore,
the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.